Welcome to Motulam Method. I'm Dr. Xanthi Mallett.
And I'm Tim Watson Munro.
Now, this is an introduction to an episode you're about to listen to with Ali Langdon, who's obviously an award-winning journalist. And Tim and I spoke to Ali about the case of Kelly Lane. She's been highly involved in this case, having written about it. Originally, she was a court reporter back in 2010 when Kelly was originally charged and found guilty of murdering her daughter, Tegan. Now, the reason for this introduction is because we've literally just found out that Kelly was eligible for parole, and today that parole has been denied. She was sentenced to a minimum of 13 and a half years without parole, and that is up in a few weeks' time. So this is a really important part in legal history, actually, because we've just seen the no body, no parole laws come in, and Kelly got caught up in those. They were brought in after the prosecution and of Chris Dawson for the murder of his wife, Lynette. They're retrospective, so they apply to any case in New South Wales where nobody has been recovered in a murder case where someone's found guilty. And Kelly Lane has been caught up in this. So we're going to do a brief introduction as to what those no body, no parole laws mean, what has happened in Kelly's case, and what that means for her going forward. So, Tim, do you want to talk to us a little bit about these no body, no parole laws and, you know, what the Lanes might be feeling now that they know that parole has not been granted under those retrospective laws?
Well, it's an interesting one philosophically, isn't it? Because parole is really, shouldn't be a form of extra punishment for people. Parole is something that's designed to monitor and facilitate a prisoner's rehabilitation into the community with supervision. The no body, no parole law seems to be a form of punishment for not disclosing information, which understandably the families of a deceased person want. They want to know where their loved one is buried. And I'm fully empathic and sympathetic to that, but it does raise a lot of philosophical issues in terms of punishment and perhaps the abuse of the parole system referable to that. It's also an interesting case because it's the first one, as I understand it, where the no parole, no body law is being tested.
I think there has been another one, but it's certainly not as high profile as this case. And I think what's unique about this case is there's, in Kelly Lane's circumstance, and we'll go more into this in the episode, there's no evidence, there's obviously no body, but there's no witnesses and there's no motive. And yet she's caught up in this law. And I was not surprised she didn't get granted parole, because if I read you the actual wording from the law that was brought in the, as I said, after Chris Dawson was found guilty, it says, this is part 135A of the Crimes Act 1999, says, parole order must not be made where the offender has not cooperated in locating the victim's body or remains. So it's extremely specific. There really is no wiggle room. And I think regardless of what the parole board felt, as Kelly has been an ideal inmate, you know, she's done everything that they behaviorally that they could have asked of her. So regardless of that, in any other circumstance, she would have been eligible for parole. But, you know, 2 years ago before these laws came in, but the parole board's hands were tied.
Well, that's the next point I was going to make. This offence, which is convicted, was a long time ago before this law existed. I'm somewhat surprised that it's as retrospective as it appears to be. I can understand it in Dawson's case. I can understand it in cases moving forward. But if you have a situation where somebody's done a lot of jail, they've reached their non-parole period, by and large they've been a model prisoner and so on, and now they're being punished against a backdrop of a circumstantial case at best, if it was that, no body, she's maintained her innocence. It's very difficult. And at a broader level, what about other people who maintain their innocence? What about people who have had nothing to do with the murder? They're being convicted. The body's been disposed of by other people. Hitmen, for example, what happens there? And if you can't disclose, even though you might want to disclose, but you don't know where the cadaver is, you spend a lot more time in jail. So it raises a lot of interesting questions from a legal and psychological and criminological perspective.
Agree. And so somebody has done some research, and the name escapes me, but someone's done some research on the implications of what happened in Queensland. There's only a handful of cases, I think around six cases, where this no body, no parole law became relevant in Queensland, and it made zero difference in compelling people to come forward. If we look at Chris Dawson's case, for example, he's been convicted, obviously. He's an older person than Kelly. He's in his 70s. You know, it's unlikely that he's going to reach his minimum parole period and that this will become an issue. So for the case that it was brought in, almost as a knee-jerk political reaction to a very high-profile case, I think other people are getting caught up in it unintentionally. And that happens when laws are brought in without thinking through all of the potential implications.
Well, I think too, it's being used as a weapon now. So it's being used, we suspect, in current murder investigations, alleged murder investigations, where I suspect that accused people are being told, if you don't lead us to the cadaver, if you don't tell us where the body is, then you are looking at life without parole or a very extensive prison sentence. So it has it's not just a tool to recover bodies. It's a tool that's been used, I think, to persuade people to be more open about their behavior. But the problem is you may have people, innocent people, falling through the cracks who genuinely have no idea about the murder or where the body is.
Well, there may be no body.
There may be nobody, exactly. The body might have been dumped at sea. Who knows? What do you do?
And I do wonder, in this particular scenario, who this is serving. As you said, these laws are meant to encourage people who can disclose where their victim's remains or body is to come forward. In the Matt Levison's case, for example, we're talking about Michael Atkins, who I would stipulate has never been found guilty of a crime, but he did dispose of Matt Levison's body. It took the Levisons 10 years to get Matt back and take him home. Obviously, those families need answers. But in this case, Kelly Lane's family is also Tegan, the missing child's family. And so who is being served when that family is fully supportive of Kelly? They believe in her innocence. Who is being served by keeping her incarcerated?
Yeah, and that leads into the next issue you raise, the impact on the family. I mean, I can't speak to that really. Who knows what the impact would be on them? But in more generic terms, I've dealt with families where accused people have been refused parole. They've made all sorts of plans for the person's re-assimilation into the community, and it doesn't eventuate, and it has a very significant impact on them emotionally. They become depressed. They feel there's a sense of futility. Some may lose confidence in the criminal justice system, particularly if there's a belief that the person who is in jail is innocent of the crime. So I don't think you can overstate the impact of something like this on the family without speaking specifically about the family, because we've never met them, or I haven't. You may have.
Yeah, I have met Kelly's mother and father, actually. Yeah, so I imagine they have been building towards parole. Obviously, these laws didn't exist until recently. And so, you know, every indication was that Kelly was going to be probably eligible for parole in just a few short weeks' time. And now she will not be eligible for release until she's got another 4.5 or so years to spend in prison. So this is going to have a huge impact on Kelly and her supporters. And I really wonder whether this is a just outcome.
The other thing, of course, is that parole is a bit of carrot for people in jail. They might be given an onerous head sentence, but a lighter non-parole period, with a significant gap between the two, and the belief that if the individual is released to parole, they can be monitored for a long time in the community, and that protects the community. The last thing you want, not in Kelly's case, but dangerous people being released to the community without any supervision.
Agree.
It could be very problematic. And at another level, having worked in prisons, having examined, 20 or 30,000 plus prisoners, the whole thing about parole is that for some people, it's an inducement to behave properly in jail. They don't want to have a bad prison conduct record, because years down the track, it can impact on their prospects of parole. Now, somebody in this situation, they've been convicted of murder. There's no body for various reasons. They claim they're innocent, or maybe the body can't be found. where's the inducement towards good behavior if you know you're going to do another 10, 20% on the bottom sentence?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's where we are leading into our podcast with Ali Langdon. There will be a second part to this with Michelle Reuters, who is from the RMIT Innocence Initiative. Now, they've been working very closely with Kelly for a number of years now and are very close to this entire process. And we recorded this before, obviously, this parole issue came up. But Michelle is a wealth of information on the case and the broader legal implications as well and what happened. So I hope you enjoy this episode and find it interesting now in the light of the fact that we know that Kelly Lane, unless and some sort of appeal occurs, I don't even know if you can appeal a parole outcome, but unless something very unusual legally happens, Kelly Lane will be spending another 4.5 or so years incarcerated.
Just as a final point, that too may impact upon her security rating, and she may find that it's more difficult to remain in medium or minimum security that extra time to serve. So it has far-reaching implications for her.
It does, and everyone in her camp supporting her. And I think for the legal system generally, I think this is a really interesting test case, and I'm not necessarily sure that justice has been served. So interested to hear your thoughts. We hope you enjoy the episode you're about to listen to. And if you want to give us any feedback, we would love to hear that by the various mechanisms where you can leave a review. Thank you very much. Let's get started. Thank you so much for joining us. Fabulous
Absolutely.
To have you
Thank
here.
You, yeah. I can't believe it was 2010 when she was sentenced.
Blows my mind. Yeah.
We've been talking about it for that long.
Yeah.
She's up for
yeah.
parole, like it's 11, 12 years ago now, right? Mm. It feels like yesterday for me too. I don't know what's happened to time. It's just flat spot, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's the big question now. Is Kelly going to get parole? And obviously, in some cases, then you can see why they would bring that in. But in a case where she's maintained her innocence, which she always has, then if there is nobody to give up, what do? It leaves you in that space, doesn't it? So
it's a tough one, right? Because I don't think this was the intention of the law for cases like Kelly. Yet this is going to be the first test case, and potentially she serves her sentence.
She got another 5 years, I think, on top of her minimum parole period. So she could be spending another, 5 years in prison. I think it was brought in for the Chris Dawsons of the world.
Absolutely. The timing would stack up with that, I think, pretty much. What were your impressions as a journalist in those early days of this case back in 2010?
It's funny because, I mean, the inquest was even earlier than that, and I would have been in my early 20s when I covered that.
So were you quite a new kind of crime journo you were first? I remember the images of, you know, her going to court and stuff. So you were taking all of this in, you know, for the inquest, et cetera.
It was one of the first court cases I did as the new court reporter for Nine News in Sydney.
Right.
And I just remember her coming to court each day and was always with her father, never with her mother, which we always found very interesting. But she'd come in with her dad and she'd sit down the front. And I've thought about this a lot since then, and my views of it have changed. Mm-hmm. There was a coldness that we all talked about, a detachment to it.
And that came across in the media, definitely. If you watch the footage, you see that.
But what I probably didn't have context to at that point, and being a little bit older that you do, is like she's also a young woman who's probably terrified in this moment. These secrets that she has kept for a very, very long time, she was embarrassed. Even at the time of the inquest, probably didn't think it would lead to the point that she was in jail for murder, but had brought shame upon her family. Mm-hmm. And that all of a sudden it's the front page, and it was more than embarrassing. It was that these years and years of secrets were all of a sudden coming out. And I just go to now, like, how would she have felt internally knowing that her life was falling apart and we were all watching?
And they were a big thing in their community, that family. Everyone knew them. You know, they were, you know, ranked high in the community, didn't they?
He was former police officer.
Yeah,
and
they were heavily involved. And I think that level of humiliation is something, you can't get behind what's going on in someone's mind.
But it's also the death and disappearance, or disappearance at any rate, of a child.
Yes.
And the expectations that a community has on mothers. So you've got to factor that into that mix that you're talking about. It would have been overwhelming for her, no doubt.
And she's a very strong, stoic person. Like, I think I watched that, and with the hindsight, with being a little bit older, because I wasn't here when it all happened. And I think that I may have responded in quite a similar way. I wouldn't have wanted to cry in front of the press pack. I would have kept my chin up. So, but the same with the Lindy Chamberlains and the Kath Folbigs. It's like they respond in a very, like, a very dignified way to all of this, like, media storm. And I think I would have done the same thing.
But I'm not sure if the perception when you're sitting at home and watching that is that it's dignified. It's that it's cold and it's removed. And it's like, that's not what a mum is. A mum's meant to do everything and meant to protect her children.
And if they don't, they cry.
And we're, you know, we're meant to be emotional.
Chamberlain was criticised for it. Kathleen Folberg was criticised for it. We expect, and it's wrong, that women who lose children or the children, that they should be all over the place, that they should emotionally decompensate. And then they erroneously join the dots and think, well, if you're not like that, you must be guilty. You're a cold, hard, psychopathic person. I don't believe that's the case at all.
No, nor do I. And did is that the impression you had when you were there watching all of that? Did you think Kelly was guilty?
No, I didn't think she was guilty. I for me, it was more, I had no idea what could have possibly happened. And it was just that idea, of course, that it wasn't just Tegan. There were these other babies. So the fact that this young woman who played competitive water polo at a very high level, who was playing when she was 8, 9 months pregnant.
She gave birth and then went and played a match.
And wearing a swimsuit, and that there were these secret babies that she had adopted out and that no one knew about, and the fact that the fathers of those babies wasn't the boyfriend at the time. So I think there was also a labelling around that as well at the time.
The moral opprobrium of it all. Terrible.
And I feel like it wouldn't happen now. But, I mean, that was also a time, so early 2000s, where in the newsroom, we'd get a call, say, there's been a murder, and you'd race out to the scene, and then you get stopped halfway because, oh, no, don't worry about it. It's just domestic violence. So we never covered
domestic violence.
And I mean, it's horrific to say that, right? But it was still this idea, not that it then meant that no one cared about the death, but we didn't report it because it was still that idea of what happens behind closed doors. It was very similar in how we didn't ever report on suicide.
Yeah.
And you've got to be very careful, obviously, even now, how you do report on it. But we just ignored it. And as we know, that doesn't fix the problem by ignoring it. So it was a very sort of different time of reporting things. So we're all sitting there going, hang on, who is this woman who's had all these secret babies and to different men, and now one's disappeared, and, you know, what's happened to it? I don't know if it was a natural conclusion that we all thought she killed the baby. Not at that point, anyway.
So people were open-minded. You've got this cold impression of her. But you obviously moved enough by the case to write a book, The Child Who Never Was, looking for Tegan Lane. And so what grasped you about this case so much that you felt the need to write a whole book on the subject? I mean, as a true crime writer, I mean, I love writing. But, like, this is, as a journalist, you know, you've chosen one case to really deep dive into.
At the beginning of your career, by the sound of it, or pretty close to.
Close. I think it was around 2006, 2007 when I
wrote
that.
So what was it about this particular case that was so...
I couldn't forget about it. Okay. I think that I was in court pretty much every day and watching this woman who intrigued me. And I did find cold, and listening to witness after witness, because I always thought someone would have known, someone had to know. And then you watch the boyfriend and former friends and her family give evidence, and you just go, like, how did that woman, how did that girl, really, she was, you know, a teenager when she had the first baby, how did she feel that there was no one in her life that she could turn to and say, this has happened, I'm going through this, that she could take on that burden and not share it. I just assumed that she must have. And then we heard from some of the water polo players that they thought she may have been pregnant. They put goggles on and they went and looked under the water and they were talking about it, but no one raised it with her.
That's what really struck
me. Not quite to do so.
But why not? Like, if that was one of my friends and I thought they were pregnant and they hadn't mentioned it, I would say something. Now, her mum was attending those water polo training sessions. She didn't how can you not notice somebody is full term pregnant? How can you sleep in a bed with somebody and not notice they are full term pregnant?
And I think this is all the things that sort of led to wanting to write the book about it, is that we've never heard a case like this ever.
Yeah.
And I mean, I personally find it sad that we're now sitting here so many years later and that then young woman is in jail for murder. Which has always sat
with
really
no witnesses, no evidence,
no motive, regardless what was said at trial, and we'll get to the trial. But there's nothing. I've never seen a case like it where somebody's in prison for the worst crime that there is, murder, on the basis of total lack of anything.
Mm. And look, and maybe it happened, but do we convince
beyond
people?
Beyond reasonable doubt.
Exactly.
I mean, you cannot say for sure that one day Kelly Lane, or Tegan Lane, under some other name, will appear.
Mm.
Like you just, no part of you can say for sure that that child is dead, let alone that she did what it was claimed at the trial that she did. I don't know. It's one that more than any story I've ever covered in my 22-year career as a journalist that has stuck with me, that I remember all of it, and it sits so uncomfortably with where it's at and how it played out.
And is that the same sense the other journalists had, do you think? Is it, I mean, you would have been talking amongst yourselves.
Very divided.
Oh, really?
Very divided. There are some who you ask today and absolutely guilty. Absolutely, she did it. Nope, she should be in
jail
for
murder.
Based
on
what? I was going to say, on what basis, if there's no body, no witnesses and mere supposition, and obviously a very cunning Crown case against her, but beyond that, why?
Just this idea that, well, we've seen her story didn't stack up. They looked for the father of the child that she said, which was a name by the name Andrew Norris or Morris, and he couldn't be found. And that story did feel like there was like different elements of her life that she'd sort of pulled together.
Mm-hmm.
That he couldn't be found, therefore that story wasn't true. And we haven't seen anything of Tegan. But can you imagine, just say, it did play out as Kelly said it played out, that she gave the child to its natural father in the hospital car park with his then girlfriend Mel from memory.
Yeah, I think that's correct. Yeah.
And say that happened, would you come forward seeing all the headlines and regardless of what you're told is that, you know, there'll be no dramas, we just want to know if this child's alive? And then one of the newspapers at one point thought they'd found Tegan.
Mm-hmm.
And it was on the front page of the paper, is this missing Tegan? And it wasn't, but it was a name that was the same and a birth that was very similar. And if you watched that, you'd have no confidence of that you could actually come forward and say, yes, this is what happened. We have the child, because why would you expose your family to that?
Assume.
On the other hand, of course, being the devil's advocate, here's somebody who's going to jail for life for a murder that you know she didn't commit. I mean, I guess it's a personal choice for everyone. I've never been in that situation, but I'd imagine if I had been, you'd come forward. But you can't speak for other people, can you?
And that may not have happened either.
Maybe
there is no Andrew Norris or Morris, and maybe that didn't happen. I mean, but this goes to that whole point. We don't know. And, I mean, I always find your thoughts on this interesting, Xanthi, as to Kelly's story, does she believe what she's saying? Is her story true? Has she now just convinced herself that that story is true? How easy is it to do that?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I always felt that there's things that we're not, I don't think we've heard the full story, and I've spoken to Kelly a number of times, as of you. I don't know. I think there are holes. I think there are reasons things are being held back. And actually, I kind of get that. You know, this is somebody's personal life, as you said, was dragged through the courts. Everyone knew about it. And I'm a very private person, so I can imagine why you'd keep things to yourself. But I don't think she killed Tegan. I think she had no reason to kill Tegan. I mean,
and she hadn't killed those other babies.
And that's the thing. What came to me is, like, from a criminological perspective, you've got, she had two abortions, then she adopted a child out, then she had Tegan, and then adopted a child out. Path of least resistance. Why would somebody kill that child? She could have just left her in the hospital. That's what struck me straight away. Walk out the hospital if you want to. Why would you do that? No, she wouldn't do that.
It doesn't match her personality. And even now, having a better understanding of her, which you didn't at the time of, you know, the inquest and even at the time of the court case, to be honest, that, you know, her students, she was a PE teacher, loved her. And and her friends talk about this very different side to Kelly.
Not cold. Gregarious, not embracing, cold.
Intelligent, charismatic. Yeah. And she's all those things.
And Kelly is a mum. And even from in jail, she was helping do the homework every afternoon, has a very, very close relationship with that child. In prison, she's set up like mentoring programs, and none of that matches this idea of Cole calculated, killed and dumped a baby's body. But that side of Kelly, the public hasn't seen.
Correct.
And has never been given an opportunity to see.
Well, all they've seen is what they've been told. And
is what we've been told as well. And I know we as media then cop it in many ways in how she's perceived, but all you can actually do is film her going into an inquest and film what's said at that time. And with the court case, all you can do is report on what the prosecution puts forward.
Do you think it was a mistake for her not to give evidence? I mean, I have views about people who have the right to silence, but I'm interested in your perspective on that.
I think sitting through that trial, it was one where, I think mothers are unfairly held to a different standard. And so I think her silence was perhaps taken as guilt. Like, well, hang on, if you've got nothing to hide, why don't you just get up there and tell us exactly what happened? But how that trial played out and the prosecution of Kelly, even in the opening remarks of Crown Prosecutor Mark Tedeschi, his opening address was that Kelly had murdered the baby and buried it under Sydney Olympic Park because that's where she one day dreamed of representing Australia in the 2000 Olympics. Now that's
an extraordinary comment when you think about it.
And with nothing to back it up, by
the way.
Exactly, yeah. And so that then ran front page of every paper. We all ran it. And the next day he was made to retract that. But the damage was done.
Worse than that, we know that when something is retracted, it actually implants it in the jurors' minds, and they're going, well, I know he retracted it, but that's how maybe she did it, right? You can just hear those conversations in the jury room, can't you?
You also had the issue, and it was, I guess, clever, canny, on behalf of the prosecution to tie the perjury charges to the murder charge. So she was facing, I think it was 2 counts of lying. So you're selected as a juror and you're sitting there and you've over the years probably read a lot about this woman. I know you don't take that into the chair when you're making your decision, but also you're sitting there going, okay, you're accused of murder, but you're also a liar.
Yeah, tendency. He linked it by tendency.
And if you're a liar, you're probably lying about this.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So by linking the two and by those two being allowed to proceed at the same time, how does that not prejudice a jury?
Because he's linked it as almost tendency evidence of lying, but almost saying, well, if you're a liar, you're capable of murder.
Mm.
Now, that's a leap. Like, that's practically over the moon, isn't it? It's so far.
But there's a character assessment that you're making as a juror in that moment before you even determine if she is guilty or
not.
And
it's the hook.
Yeah. You know,
it's the hook that then colours the jury's perception of the accused person.
Mm.
That's why I use the term cunning. You know, it was very craftily done. Within his rights to do it, but you've got to wonder about that. All the emotive kind of imagery and language surrounding that case and the way the trial was run was quite extraordinary, I thought.
Well, some of the things he wasn't allowed to do, though, so reversing the onus of proof. He presented, I think it was 10 different questions Kelly had to be able to answer to demonstrate she wasn't guilty. It's like, well, hang on.
That's not how our court system works.
Thank God that's not how the court system works, because proving your innocence is actually almost impossible. It's up to the Crown to prove guilt beyond reasonable doubt. Mm. And he used a number of tricks to do that. Some of it was cunning, but some of it crossed the line.
And I think it did hurt her not taking the stand and explaining her story. But I also think the way that trial had played out, what would have happened to her had she taken the stand? I don't know if you I mean, as a defence lawyer, I don't know if you could put your client in.
That's why they don't. It opens a Pandora's box because you're there to answer every question put to you. And we've looked at other cases where this has occurred, with Kath Folbig, for example, where, you know, she gave evidence and it became a runaway train wreck. So it's a very risky strategy to do that, and it puts a lot of pressure on the accused person. But I think too, and it's not about this case, just as a general principle, if your back's against the wall, your character's been assassinated the extent that hers was, you got nothing to lose. You need to open up your soul to the jury to let them see the other side of you. And that certainly didn't seem to come across in the trial, did it?
No, and I think actually getting to know Kelly, I think actually had she spoken, she would have been roasted, yes, by Tedeschi. But I think the other side of her may have come out too, the intelligent, charismatic, engaging side that might have helped. And I know certainly now she wants her opportunity. And I think being the adult woman she is now, I'm not saying she was a child, but the mature woman she is now, I think she would have taken the opportunity looking back. But, you know, 20...
It's a minefield.
Yeah.
But
it is, but yeah.
In the absence of that, you're just left with one image, and that's the image of somebody who's capable of murdering their child. And I suspect that that was the dynamic that was in play.
Yeah, it very much reminded me of the Lindy Chamberlain prosecution. Is that how it felt at the time?
It does now.
Yeah.
I think at that time it was so chaotic. And I know, I mean, the jury was divided for a very long time. They took a long time to come back. And I think even by that point, the defence and the prosecution were looking at a new trial date because the thought was that it was unlikely that they were going to be able to come to a decision. So when we got the word that the jury was back, it was very surprising, considering how divided they had been. And yeah, they came, and I just remember hearing that, and my thoughts were, how can you say for sure that this child is dead?
Yeah, and that's still a big question.
I mean, as you say, there was no body, there was no evidence, there were no witnesses.
Just a lot of emotion.
A lot of emotion. And I think that vision of Kelly at the wedding 2 days after Tegan disappeared.
Heartless. In inverted commas.
Yeah, heartless. It really hurt her. But I look at that very differently now to think, oh my gosh, like you were so, it was so necessary to keep this hidden from everyone. You knew if you didn't turn up to this wedding, there'd be questions. So you left the baby at the hospital. No, that wasn't the right order, was it? No,
yeah, two days. Yeah,
did she go back after that or not?
She went straight home and I think got changed for the wedding.
Yes.
And went out. So she handed, according to Kelly, handed the baby over to Andrew Norris and Mel, the partner, went home, got changed for the wedding.
2 hours later, after leaving hospital,
she was at
the wedding. And, yeah, that idea of that was seen as heartless and I didn't even care what she'd just done and just off on with her life. It was more that idea of I have to turn up, I have to be there. It's how I now see it.
That's really sad, isn't it?
Because otherwise people are going to wonder, where am I? And then all of a sudden are all these secrets and all these lies and is it all going to come out? Like, I now see a woman so terrified and scared of...
And young.
And young of being exposed that she just had to get on with it and turn up. And, I mean, how now, at this point, having had two kids of my own, I don't know how the heck you do that 2 days after giving birth, that you front like that. Physically, I don't know how you do it.
And yet, you know, I'm not challenging that, but children are given up for adoption all the time. Mothers hand over their child and they get on with their life. She had prior experience of doing that. So it was probably not such a big leap for her to do it that it may be for others.
Well, I don't know. We spoke to Michelle and Michelle said after each of those children she gave up, she was devastated. You know, and again, the public didn't see that. They just think there's this, it's just a baby, get rid of it, I don't care. And that is not, it's not the Kelly that I know. It's not the Kelly Michelle knows. And it's not the Kelly the public knows.
And I think even that idea of where it's like, well, hang on, how promiscuous is this woman who's, you know, going and having babies with all these? And then once you have a bit more of an understanding of what Kelly's gone through in life, which isn't open to share, you understand a lot more about her, and she's far more complex, sensitive than what the public perception is.
Yeah.
But the public hasn't had the opportunity to see that. And I think that will play out again when she comes up for parole. Obviously, all these discussions are going to come up again. Mm. And I guess part of my fear is that the conversations will still be like that. And I'm going to wonder if we haven't learned any lessons from Kath Vollebygg. It's like, seriously, you know, how many years did she spend in prison? She came across as hard and cold, and look at the mess that's been created there that's still not resolved.
But it is such a pickle for them.
Yes.
To then, what do they do? There is now this law which exists. If you don't tell us where the body is, you don't get parole.
And it's the first case. It's like the test case of this new law, yet we're in this position where there is probably no body to actually give up.
With no discretion, right?
I don't know.
I'm not totally clear on that law.
I guess that's what we'll find out.
Or it's going to be tested.
When it's tested.
Well, we do know that Kelly is on work release, though. So you would think that they are at least considering parole, because otherwise why are they letting her out on work release, on day release, if they're going to keep her in prison to the full length of her sentence?
Well, that would be very cruel and cynical if that was at the back of their minds. You would hope that she's being prepared for release to the community. And that's the normal career path. That's what happens.
Yeah, well, that's certainly how it looks. But, you know, we just have to wait and see until May. And I bet they're wondering this too. Like, what are we going to do?
Well, can you imagine how anxious she is right now?
Yes.
This idea, you've just spent all that time in prison. You just want to get home to your family.
And she's done everything right. Everything right in prison. She deserves parole. Mm. And then because of somebody like Chris Dawson, she gets caught up in this nobody, no parole law retrospectively.
And I like that law.
Yes.
I like it.
For the cases. Chris Dawsons of the world.
And you also had, you know, cases like Bruce Burrell, and where he killed Kerry Whelan and Dorothy Davis. And there are a few others where you can totally understand why this law exists.
Matt Leveson, 10 years they waited for Matt's body.
I don't want to get ahead of what may occur, but let's say she's denied parole. It would inevitably be challenged. And there would be test cases around it. I can't imagine that the legislators had in mind that every person in every situation stays in jail forever. It would be pretty heartless to have that on your mind, I think.
It's a very contentious case, though. But on, like, following on from Vollebygg, are they really going to want to deny her parole, given we now see that is probably one of the most egregious miscarriages of justice this country has seen? Mm. So are we going to want to do it again?
And you'd hope not. You'd really hope not. Like, I think we all agree, whatever happened. I mean, I have an issue with the fact she was ever charged with murder.
Me too.
Say she did exactly what the prosecution said, and that she dumped the baby and it died, and like, you've got to go to state of mind for this brand new mum and what the intent was. Is that premeditated? Is that murder?
Yeah.
Well, arguably it's not. And, you know, we don't know. It's all hypothetical. But, you know, there could have been an argument of postnatal depression, for example, infanticide. I mean, murder's the big one, isn't it? Because there's an absolute intent to end another person's life. How do you actually prove that? Mm. And how do you prove it when there's no body?
No body, so there's no injuries. We just don't know.
But do you even look at where cases we see today where new mums dump a baby somewhere and all the messaging around it, you are not in trouble, just come forward. We want to make sure you
are
okay.
We had one recently, was left in a garden that was found. Mm. Yeah.
That was one in Western Sydney.
Yeah, that's correct, yeah.
And the language around it, you are not in trouble, just come forward. We want to make sure you're okay, because we understand that you're not well in a situation
you need help.
where you make decisions like that.
Yeah. Mm.
I know the answer to this, having spoken with you, but you've followed this case for a long, long time. You've written about it. You're pretty clear on your views now. But have you changed your mind about her at all over the years?
I have. I've softened. And I think from those early days of covering the inquest, where I think, you know, my mind was just blown in a sense of who could do this and how could this happen, and there was intrigue, and she was cold. She appeared cold. And I don't think I've ever felt that she murdered the baby. I've been unsure. I haven't known. And I still don't know.
Do you believe her story, or do you think there are holes?
I don't believe her story. And I've told Kelly that, but I don't believe that she should be in jail for murder.
Beyond reasonable doubt. I mean, what you've spoken about is you've got doubt.
Mm.
one way or the other. There's doubt.
I don't see how there could not be doubt.
And I just think there are so many other options at that time. Like, you know, did she sell the baby? And the thing is that we didn't, you know, she had this story at the trial that it was given to Andrew Norris or Morris. The prosecution had this story. And there were lots of bits of information that came out through the inquest that never matched either side of this of the story, where just sort of puts up a couple of other options as to what possibly happened.
And everyone assumed that his name was Andrew Norris or Morris. But this, remember, he was a married man having an affair with a much younger woman, right? So I was always wondering whether she even knew his real name in the first place. Maybe his name was Andrew. But, you know...
Or Alfred.
Who knows? Because at the end of the day, maybe he's just having a bit of a fling with a young woman and doesn't actually want her to know his actual identity. There were so many, like,
so
all these things kind
things.
Of went through
so
my head.
So many things that the, how,
he may
how
be
that
looking
could
for
have
the wrong guy since 2010.
And, I mean, and their idea was that, okay, we've looked for every Andrew Norris or Morris within this age group, both here and overseas, but then post the trial, there was, I don't know which newspaper it was, found Andrew Norris's and Morris's who fit that age range and had lived in Sydney who were never questioned. So it was sort of this definitive, she said it was this person or this person. Well, we have ruled out every single option, both in Australia or overseas, so therefore
that's
not
a big
true.
Call,
he doesn't
isn't it?
Exist.
He doesn't exist.
In the entire universe, we've spoken to every Andrew Norris. I mean, please.
I can't remember what the age gap that they looked at and how that was presented. But, you know, it was just another thing that the jury heard and went, oh, okay, right, so she's lied about.
Yes.
And look, and maybe she did lie, as you say, elements of it, but... Gee, that's a big
doesn't
leap.
Make you a murderer.
Exactly. And that's the leap that
difference.
Was made.
I think as you eloquently pointed out, you know, they tied the lying in with the charge of murder. And I can tell you, I've given evidence in front of juries for a long, long time. Once you plant the seed, it flourishes. It doesn't matter how much judicial direction you get about remove that thought from your thinking. It never happens. It amplifies it, in fact. So
and this was a case where the judge himself, Anthony Whealy, it was his final criminal trial, I think, before he retired. And he has always said that this verdict has, you know, sits uncomfortably with him. He's never been okay with how this trial played out. That's a big call.
It's a big call.
And he said that publicly a number of times. Yeah, he's very dissatisfied.
He's a fabulous judge, sadly missed.
He was very fair.
Yes.
Yeah, he was one of my favourites over the many, many years I covered courts. A good man. And, yeah, for him to come out and publicly say that is enormous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you mentioned it earlier, looking back on how women were judged then, do you think then if Kelly were being prosecuted now, it might be different that we don't judge women as harshly? Have we learned anything?
I would certainly hope so, but I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Is probably my honest answer. I still think to this day that women are held to this sort of higher standard as mothers than fathers as to...
And protectors.
Yeah. As that is our... It's almost like that's our primary... I mean, it is our primary job. It's also fathers. But I just think that women are judged more harshly when there's a thought that a mother has harmed
and
a
I
child.
And I think it's women that judge women more harshly. Just...
Oh, I agree.
Well, look what goes on in women's prisons if you happen to be a child killer. You know, it's hell on steroids, as we've discussed over a number of essays.
I've seen a weeny bit of that. Like, I don't have children. And so people say, have you got children when you first meet them? And if a woman asks me, they'll go, oh, have you got children? I say no. And they go, oh.
Really?
I go, yeah. Oh, I get the look. I get the, oh, poor you. And I go, no, no, it's fine. It's a choice. And then they go, oh, like, what is wrong with you? And then they, yeah, it's like, I was like, okay, that's weird. Men just go, all right.
All right.
Yeah,
on.
Men are kind of like, they don't judge you for not having children or choosing not to have children, but women either think they feel sorry for you or there's clearly something wrong with you because you don't want a baby.
I never ask the question because it's not the most interesting thing about the person I'm talking to.
Do they have
to?
A dog? That I'm way more interested in if they have a dog than if they have
well,
children.
Well, you have a very nice dog.
She's so. Beautiful. She's the best dog in the world.
What is your dog?
Oh, who knows? She's a mix. She's a rescue, but she is perfect. Yeah, she's perfect.
It is funny that, though, isn't it? That,
yes.
That is often the question that gets asked and the assumptions that are made around it.
Yeah, but women go, something wrong with you. And so that, I think, perpetuates into when we judge women who are accused of harming a child and just go, well, you know, that's even worse, right? Because you would harm somebody, a child, you know, that you've given birth to. You're a monster. And we still
and
do
think,
that.
And look, and I think that element of it hasn't changed. But you talk about have attitudes changed. I think perhaps I'd like to think less judgment then about the life's choices that she made at that time, or there'd be a more sympathetic ear as to what was going on in Kelly's life as to why that played out as it did. I'd like to think that part has changed, but I still think this idea of how dare you as a mother hurt your child, and fair, like no mother should hurt their child,
but no one
should hurt a child.
But we don't judge them as harshly. It's almost like, well, you know, it's a man. Whereas whether it's a mother. It's...
And that then plays into the issue of remorse. I mean, if you haven't done it, how can you feel sorry for something you haven't done? But it will be weaponized. So you've shown no regret, no remorse for the crime you've committed. And that just plays into you're the harsh, cold, detached human being that kills children. And it becomes a self-perpetuating myth in many ways.
And so we're kind of waiting to see what the next instalment of this is going to be. We've got a few months to wait until May next year. I take it you all next – oh, maybe I should say that differently, yeah. So we're coming to the next stage of this case, aren't we, waiting to see whether Kelly is going to get parole. I take it you're going to remain interested and keep following this case?
Absolutely. Yeah. May 2024. It'll be intriguing to see how this plays out. I mean, until that new law came in, I think we all just assumed first chance of parole. She's been a model citizen in jail. She's helped so many other young women in there.
And not to get parole. She's just that kind of person. She's helped them get healthy, get fit, you know, improve themselves, develop confidence.
She's a PE teacher, right?
I know. And she's still a PE teacher in prison.
And had this law not come in, I mean, you don't know for sure, obviously, but you would assume that parole in May was a given, and this is now a spanner in the works, and you just wonder how many spanners does she have to deal with?
So what was the full sentence, 25 years, thereabouts?
Yeah, God, hang on, bear with me. Yeah,
sorry, I shouldn't have asked you that. But
No, hang on, I'll do a quick...
No, I don't think it was that long.
So if she doesn't get parole, how much longer will she have to do?
I think it was like 18 years, I'm thinking.
18 years with non-parole of 13.
Got it.
Yeah.
Because the 13 is almost is up.
Is no,
that's
almost
what I meant.
Up.
So she's got 5 years to go anyway if she doesn't get parole, correct?
Yeah.
And then with the law, if she serves her whole sentence, can she be released? Or they can hold you still if you don't declare where the body is?
No, I think it's the parole. That's my understanding. She can't get parole. But once she's served her complete sentence, she will be released. But she can't be released early from that sentence.
5 more years.
Yeah, that's a really
that's
long
a
time.
That's a long time.
If you haven't done anything, especially, imagine. You know, and for her daughter too. That's another 5 years without having her mum at home.
Yeah. And that's the cruelest part of all of this, is that there is a young woman who's been deprived of her mother for so long. And that's, I think, as we talked about, that's a sub that people don't understand. Kelly is a beautiful mother to her child.
And the stigma that's going to be attached to Kelly and her daughter as a result, that daughter will be carrying. And I know that Kelly will want to continue to fight to clear her name. She's never stopped. She's always maintained her innocence. And she will keep up that fight.
It's more than just leaving jail and putting that episode of her life behind her. It is, you know, to walk around and to be
your
child killer.
Yeah.
Same as Kath. She wants her name cleared. You know, she may have been pardoned, she may have been released, but at this moment in time, Kath Fulvig is still a serial killer.
Mm.
And she's killed formerly four of her own children, well, three of her own children in manslaughter.
Mm.
And she wants
free, but that's not truly free.
That's not free though, is it? Yeah, it's not free. It's not free.
It's the ongoing opprobrium. So I think we're agreed this may well be another miscarriage of justice. What do you think?
I think so.
Me too. Always have.
Strongly feel that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Even if, worst case, Kelly did kill Tegan, there is no evidence. Therefore, you should not be in prison. Mm. That's how the legal system works, or at least how it should work. It's not that I believe she did kill Tegan.
No, and I like that very clear as well. I don't think she killed her child.
Mm.
I just don't think that is the type of person she is. What happened, I don't know. I think she believes her story, but whether that story is true, I don't know. But that, in my mind, doesn't make her a child killer.
And this case, to me, like Kath, like Lindy, some cases are bigger than just that person, if that makes sense. What happened to that person is awful, but the case is bigger socially than that one person. And Kelly's case is a bit like that for me. Maybe it's because I think women are judged and there's a whole social issue around it. Do you think that this is more than Kelly? This is a societal problem in the way we actually judge people differently?
Definitely. And I think even just tying it into the cases that the other cases you've mentioned with Lindy and Kathleen, for sure, this story became far bigger than Kelly. It's become how we judged women who were perceived to have killed their own children and everything that goes with that.
With a long legal tail, because of the no body, no parole, it has the potential to reshape law in New South Wales as well. It's just the case that keeps on going, isn't it?
And that's the next hurdle Kelly will have to face, is that parole. And then if it is denied, there will ultimately be an appeal, and that, as you said, will set case law, and on it may go. Or they may decide to release her and we just have to wait patiently.
All I know is that there's a daughter at home who deserves her mum back.
Exactly, and a mum who deserves to spend time with her daughter being a mum. Mm.
And to get back into the community. And anyway, it's a very tough case, this one. Thanks for joining us. Your insights have been invaluable.
My pleasure. Absolutely. Yeah.
Quite extraordinary how much detail you remember when you sit down like this.
Mm. These cases grab you, don't they? It's like some of the cases I've worked on, I can remember all of it, and it's just like they just hook into you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ali.
Thank you.